Welcome to Paleo Cinema Podcast 148. My name is Terry Frost, and this time I'm looking at a couple of movies from 1974. One really good, and one kind of interesting, but not quite so good. They are, in reverse order, Golden Needles from 1974, starring Joe Don Baker and Elizabeth Ashley. And also, we're going then to The Black Windmill, starring Michael Caine and Donald Pleasence. So sit back and I'll get the contact details out of the way.
Paleo Cinema Podcast appears every 2 weeks and is a podcast of classic film appreciation. The rules are simple and two in number. Firstly, the movie has to be more than 20 years old, and secondly, I have to like it. Feedback is very important, so you can leave reviews on iTunes. You can email me at cultguru@gmail.com, that's cult with a K. Or you can head over to the Paleo Cinema Cafe on Facebook. You can like the page there and add your 2 cents worth. Now, this podcast contains adult language and concepts, so enjoy it.
Okay, so how the fuck is everybody? We're kind of doing fine here. It's heading into that season where the reindeer shit hits the roof and the weather here gets a lot hotter and people start wearing shorts and hanging out around barbecues and drinking and talking shit and all of those usual things, which are slightly different than the Northern Hemisphere Christmas time, but that's how we roll down here. It's going to be summer, it's going to be warm, and we are going to party. So let's see. So we've got two movies for this time around. They just happen to be both made in 1974, and the first one is Golden Needles, directed by Robert Klaus, which stars Joe Don Baker, Elizabeth Ashley, and Burgess Meredith, who steals the movie. And then we're going to look at some Cold War Michael Caine, which is not Harry Palmer related, but shows him playing a different kind of spy in The Black Windmill, directed by Don Siegel, and it also stars John Vernon and Donald Pleasence, who steals the movie. So I'm just going to bring up my Letterboxd and we'll see what I've been watching lately. I started out with a classic, The Yakuza. I think Sidney Pollack directed it, which stars Robert Mitchum and Brian Keith and Richard Jordan, a bunch of other people. Really nice little one. The script was by Paul Schrader, amongst other people. And it's one of those ones that I revisit now and then. I've got it on DVD, and it's an underrated movie from around late 1970s, I think. For the ABC radio gig, we decided to do a bit of a thriller. Not a really violent one, but a nice classic little thriller. So my suggestion for that one was Wait Until Dark, starring Audrey Hepburn, Alan Arkin and Richard Crenna. And we went with that, and Liz enjoyed it. It was a lot of fun to talk about that particular movie, and particularly Alan Arkin playing Harry Rote Jr. from Scarsdale, and how he kind of low-keys the role until suddenly action is needed and then he goes totally bug-fuck nuts. So we both had a bit of fun with that. I did see also the Mark Hartley documentary, Electric Boogaloo, about Canon Films. And it's a good overview of the Menicum, the Golden Globus axis, and the rise and fall of Canon Films and the crazy kind of movies they made. I don't think it's as good as Not Quite Hollywood or Machete Maidens Unleashed, but I think it does kind of cram a lot into about a 90-minute running time. So I picked that up on DVD here, and it's going into the archive of documentaries. Let's see what else I saw. I saw the kind of partly kind of pseudo found footage movie Into the Storm about an enormous mega hurricane hitting somewhere in America and wrecking the fuck out of everything and doing some magnificently ropey things with some of the CGI, but other bits of it were fantastic. It's an effects movie. It doesn't have too much else going for it apart from that. It does have one really cool moment at the end of it involving a large truck which is designed to kind of weather tornadoes, and doesn't quite do it in this case. And so it's one of those ones that maybe you should see, maybe you shouldn't, but it's definitely very effects heavy and not too bad. I did see a science fiction movie made by Noel Clarke, the guy who played Ricky or Nicky or something like that on Doctor Who at one stage. And it's called The Anomaly. And it's kind of low budget. It has Brian Cox in it as well. Not the scientist Brian Cox, but the actor Brian Cox. And stars Noel Clarke himself. It's a kind of amnesiac kind of thing. A little bit science fictional, or very much science fictional, but very much kind of a memento kind of thing. Not too bad for the size of the film and the limitations of the budget. So you might want to check that one out if you get a chance. I did see a movie that was recommended to me by Kirsten McDermott, and with whom I'm going to speak about it at a future Martian Drive-In podcast, and that's the Australian horror film The Babadook, starring Essie Davis. And really nice, creepy horror film. It comes at it, because it was written and directed by a woman, it comes at it from a different angle than it would if it was kind of a bit of a sausage fest. And I won't talk too much else about it because I really want to have a chat with Kirsten and bounce off her feelings about it. But the resolution to the horror plot is very much a non-traditional and non-male-oriented one. So if you get a chance to see The Babadook, I definitely recommend it. I did see the latest craze of young adult dystopia science fiction action films being Divergent, which is kind of ordinary, so I won't talk more about that. Let's see what else there is. A really, really low-budget science fiction movie called Coherence, which was filmed for something like $50,000 or $60,000. It's about a bunch of people having a house party, and a comet goes over, and suddenly the alternate universes start springing up around them. And it's all done. There's a bit of an improvised feel to it. A lot of the dialogue seems to be improvised within the plot. But it's not too bad. It's a little bit primerish while being a lot more accessible. And I kind of recommend that one. It's one of those ones that you really should check out for the simple reason that it's something that's not done too badly at all on an incredible micro budget. I did see a spy movie. I'm kind of going on a bit of a spy movie kick at the moment. So I saw a recent Pierce Brosnan spy movie called The November Man, which I kind of recommend. It's based on a series of novels that I can't find copies of anywhere. And he plays a retired secret agent dragged back into the business by some very nasty characters, one of which is a bit of a kind of not quite Vladimir Putin character. But I think it's not too bad. It's a little bit, there's nothing there you haven't seen before, but it's a nice little action flick if you want to kick back and just watch a bit of action. So, yeah, that one's a kind of a recommendation. Now, the other thing I did for the ABC Local Radio Darwin gig was an Australian musical, an Aboriginal Australian musical made by a guy called Jimmy Chai and his band Cuckolds. And it's called Brand New Day. If you haven't seen Brand New Day, I recommend it. It's a nice feel-good musical with a kind of political sensibility that makes it even more interesting. The more you dive into the history of it, the more you enjoy it. So Liz and I had a chat about that, and we both had a bit of fun with it. It really is one of my go-to feel-good films of the moment. I've got a number of them. Most of them seem to be musicals for some reason. But Brand New Day is definitely on there, and it does have a couple of moments of real wonder and really beautiful. The cinematography was done by the same guy who did all the cinematography for the Lord of the Rings films and the Hobbit films, and the colour values really pop. There are some really saturated colours when it's appropriate for a musical to have saturated colours, and there are also kind of more muted tones. Jeffrey Rush is in it, Magda Szubanski. Jessica Morboy's in it, Missy Higgins is in it, Ernie Dingo's in it. If you don't know those names, it doesn't matter. But, yeah, so I really enjoyed revisiting Brand New Day. So that's about all I have been watching. I've been watching a lot of television, and unfortunately, the vacuum sucking up my time at the moment is my Xbox. I got the Xbox out and hooked it up to the spare monitor here in the man cave. So basically, if I sit in this chair and do a 180 on the chair and pivot it around and slide it a little bit forward, I can play Xbox rather than sitting at the desk. And I've been playing Diablo 3 and it's been sucking up a shit ton of my time. So anyway, I'm going to take a break now, and when I get back, we're going to talk about the first of the two films, this one being Robert Klaus's Golden Needles from 1974, starring Joe Don Baker, Elizabeth Ashley, and Burgess Meredith. There's nothing I would rather be than to be an aborigine and watch you take my precious land away. For nothing gives me greater joy than to watch you fill each girl and boy with superficial existential shit. Now you may think I'm cheating, but I'll be satisfied to rebuild your convict ships and set you on the tide. There's nothing I would rather be than to be an aborigine and dream of just what heaven must be like. Where moth and rust do not corrupt, when I die I know I'll be going up, cause you know that I've had my hell on earth. God gave us ten commandments, we know we are in war. Judgment day is coming, we'll always be in war. There's nothing I would rather be than to be an aborigine and watch you take my precious land away. Oh no, no, no. That was Nothing I Would Rather Be from the soundtrack of Brand New Day.
According to an ancient legend, the human body has 7 forbidden acupuncture points. If stimulated correctly with a special golden needle, the result is everlasting youth, pleasure, and vitality. Incorrectly, the result is agonizing death. From the gracious mansions of Beverly Hills to the teeming waterfront of the China Sea, 7 people seek the treasure of pain and pleasure, the fabulous golden needles.
It's beautiful, as they say.
250,000.
You're insane.
We shall mention any amount of money that is offered.
Any amount?
What do you want?
30,000 American dollars.
You got it.
Seven desperate people on one desperate chase to find the golden needles. He who owns them can rule the world.
That is the extremely 1970s trailer for Golden Needles, a 1974 American action-adventure film starring Joe Don Baker, Elizabeth Ashley, Ann Southern, Jim Kelly, Burgess Meredith, and Roy Chow. It was directed by Robert Klaus, who had just had enormous success with a couple of other films, the first one of which was, of course, Enter the Dragon in 1973, the Bruce Lee movie that went totally ballistically, crazily popular, particularly after Bruce Lee stepped on the rainbow. But he then followed it up with the Jim Kelly movie, Black Belt Jones. Now, Jim Kelly, great martial artist and a lot of fun, but he wasn't a really good actor. So the movie that Robert Klaus decided to follow up these two with was a really weird choice, because I don't think Joe Don Baker as a romantic kind of charismatic comedy lead is really, you wouldn't be the first guy you go to for that kind of thing. You get someone off TV like Tony Franciosa or Doug McClure or somebody like that, but no, Joe Don Baker was the guy of choice. Of course, he'd made a couple of films that were quite successful at the time. He got a lot of critical acclaim, particularly Pauline Kael for Walking Tall, the movie about Buford Pusser, the sheriff in the southern town. And he wasn't in the sequel, Walking Tall, too, but he kind of impressed people with that. He then went on to play the villain in Don Siegel's Charlie Varick with Walter Matthau, which I'm going to watch again very, very soon because I enjoy the film. and then came on to do Golden Needles. And he dropped a bit of weight for this one. You could tell he dropped it a little bit, but he's still not going to be anybody's idea of svelte. But, yeah, it's kind of one of those weird choices that people made in the 1970s when it came to action film starring. There wasn't an exact science in those days. But Robert Klaus himself was quite interesting. The first feature film he did after working in television for a number of years was Darker Than Amber, the Rod Taylor movie about Travis McGee, the John D. McDonald character, in a long-running series of 21 novels. So he was a good action director in that sense, and of course Enter the Dragon did have that action emphasis to it. Robert Klaus did have a disability as well, which kind of isn't really well known. He was totally deaf, which made directing a film, I suppose, problematic at best. But you can kind of tell it from the way the dialogue flows in these films, where dialogue isn't the strong suit of any Robert Klaus film, but all strength to Mr. Klaus for still maintaining a career in spite of what would seem to be an enormous disability for that kind of a job. So, the plot of the film. The trailer says pretty much what it is. There's a golden statue with a whole bunch of acupuncture needles in it, and if you are stabbed with the needles in the right way, you not only have immortality, but sexual vitality comes back. And this is demonstrated best right at the start of the film, where an old dottery Chinese guy is perforated by these needles and then taken away by four attractive women. Doesn't end well for him. I'm not going to do a spoiler on this kind of title sequence thing, but needless to say, someone steals the golden statue away from him and doesn't leave him in any condition to follow them. So everybody wants a statue, of course. The statue is the thing that's going to give everybody immortality. It's the Maltese Falcon of the movie in that sense. So what happens is that Felicity, played by Elizabeth Ashley, is hired by a man called Winters, played by Burgess Meredith, to get the statue. And the statue is currently being held by a character called Lin To, played by Roy Chow. To do that, she get through his business partner, gets a guy called Dan, played by Joe Don Baker, of course, to steal the statue while it's in Hong Kong. Dan has some unusual demands on the job. He doesn't want to do this anymore. He's doing an import-export business in Hong Kong, exporting stuff to America with his partner. He really isn't interested very much, but he tells her he'll do it if she gives him the $30,000, and she gives him a hug and tells him that she loves him. Now, I don't know about you, but this doesn't strike me as either A, very nice, or B, the real way to get somebody to cooperate with you. If you're that desperate in Hong Kong to get a cuddle and to have someone tell them that they love you, then you probably can, for not too much money in 1970s Hong Kong, hire somebody to do that. But no, he decides he wants to do this with Felicity, and she's desperate enough to actually agree to it, and by implication agree to sleep with him if he gives her the assistance she requires to steal the golden statue. So off goes Dan. Now, he's a big lummox of a Texas guy. Joe Don Baker was never a physically attractive kind of guy. The statue's being held in an apartment above a snake market in Hong Kong where people buy and sell various kinds of snakes. There are large boas, there are smaller, deadlier snakes. And as he's leaving, the guys chasing him decide one of the ways to stop him is to throw a room full of cobras at him. So basically they throw a box full of cobras into the room, and Joe Don Baker's character has to try to dodge them to get out, because cobras, of course, are not very nice snakes. In fact, Bruce Lee was bitten by a snake during the making of Enter the Dragon. So somehow Dan escapes and gets them the golden statue, which turns out that the way they're going to smuggle it into America basically is in hiding it in a large clay jug of aromatic oil. Now, they're exporting three of those jugs, and there's a bit of fun and games when they try to trace the jugs and to try to find out which of the three jugs his business partner, who has now been killed, hid the golden statue in. While they're searching for the statue, they have an encounter with Mr. Winter, played by Burgess Meredith. Now, I'm going to play some of Burgess Meredith playing Mr. Winter because he's having a lot of fun in this movie. And he, when he comes on board, he really does lift things a lot from the kind of running around doing silly things part of the movie. Suddenly you get this bit with a bit of character, a character actor of great skill and long, long experience, having a bit of fun in a movie that's not going to be an expensive movie. He knows this. He knows it's not an A film in any way, but he just decides to have a little bit of fun playing the character. And here's what you get. Just to set the scene, Jeff, played by Jim Kelly, and Dan, played by Joe Don Baker, of course, are ushered into a very large room, and the room seems to be empty, and it's an incredibly impressive room in a Beverly Hills mansion. And they walk out of the room not knowing what's going on, and then this happens.
You won't have to chain her. No, you see her again. I just wanted to surprise you. It was perfectly amazing. You know, I sat there in absolute stillness. You never even saw me. You didn't. You looked at me twice, and you never saw me. Oh, I'm delighted at work. I never did it before.
No, gentlemen. No, it isn't madness. It's just that suddenly I feel very, very old. And when you get old, you know, you struggle about for any kind of amusement. And the longer you live, the harder it is for you to stay amused. That's one of the great, I think, pities of life. Huh? Now, I've collected everything in the world. Look. Hey, but collecting things isn't enough. And playing games isn't enough. Being funny isn't enough. And even power is a pain in the ass. Now, I try to be nice and generous. And you wait anxiously for the promised land and the promised packages. And lo and behold, they arrive. And your heart begins to pound like it did when you were very young. And you very carefully unwrap the great Christmas present under the great Christmas tree. And then, well, it isn't there. It isn't there! I thought it would work because I trusted her. And you know why I trusted her? Huh? Because she has no soul. God, I gave the lady $300,000. What she brought me? She brought me some aromatic oil. Now, I'm aware that there's an energy crisis, but it's a little absurd, don't you agree?
Hmm. Mistaken jars, mistaken people, mistakes.
Well, I tell you that all mistakes are going to end within 24 hours. Now, you'll get me the statue and the needles and bring them to this specific spot. And if you don't, you will be subtracted from this good earth. You there, if you think I exaggerate, I don't. Begins now immediately. You only have 24 hours, and when I count to 10, I want you to be out of this house and on your way. Hey!
And Burgess Meredith is dressed quite interestingly in this movie too. He wears very flamboyant bow ties. There's a slight indication that he may be gay, the character, not Burgess Meredith. And he just seems to lift the movie a lot. And there's also another couple of scenes where one of Dan's friends runs a little gambling establishment in Hong Kong. And that character is played by Anne Southern, an actress who had her career start in the 1930s and 1940s and is probably best known to kind of trivia geeks, playing the voice of my mother, the car, in the short-lived and much-hated television series. She plays a character called Finzi, and she sits in the middle of the chaos of a Chinese gambling den wearing a pink feather boa and a kind of bouffant blonde wig. And she does get a couple of nice little moments in there, playing off against Joe Don Baker, which kind of make it work. Now, for the most part, this movie is an action thing. It's kind of got that little bit of fantasy with the golden needles and the immortality thing. It's got Jadon Baker as a big schlub of a guy. But there are some nice action sequences in here in the slums of Hong Kong. Now, I don't know whether they're slums now. I don't know much about Hong Kong. I've never been there. The closest I've been is a stopover in Singapore. But it's a place I've wanted to visit. And if anybody wants to shout me a trip to Hong Kong, I'm more than happy to accept. But there's a chase through the slums of Hong Kong where Jadon Baker finds the statue, the genuine statue. There is a fake statue involved in the storyline, as you can probably guess from the Maltese Falcon allusion that I made to it. And he starts running away from these bad guys. Now, the bad guys are pretty hip because what they do is this. They start telling people in this Hong Kong slum that Jadon Baker's character Dan has killed a child and they need to stop him. So as he's being chased, first of all, by three or four guys, it slowly escalates until he's being chased by an entire neighborhood of pissed off Chinese guys who are trying to basically grab him because they've heard that he killed a child. And the action sequences are quite well paced here. Jadon Baker, not the most nimble of people, but he does kind of run around quite effectively, being chased through little narrow alleyways and across sampans and other boats. And really, it ends up being quite a crazy scene there until finally they got him backed up like a kind of a pack of dogs with a fox up a tree. Though he's not up a tree, he's actually up a chain wire fence. But, yeah, it kind of makes it really interesting. And if nothing else you get from this film, you do get a view of the more underprivileged parts of Hong Kong as they were in the 1970s. That's something that gets a little bit of a mention, too, when Jim Kelly's character and John Saxon's character, Roper, in Enter the Dragon are being carried through, I think it's Aberdeen Harbour, on a little sampan, a little boat. And they start talking about how slums are the same everywhere. So it's a continuation of that kind of thing. And, that lifts it a little bit out of the ordinary. Now, this movie, people will in Australia will know, who rented and purchased VHS tapes back in the early 1980s. This was one of the movies that was everywhere. It was in every video shop. And Roadshow put it out with those blue-covered VHS tapes. Roadshow Video in Australia were looking for content to put out on the shelves and to support the rental market. And so a lot of these films from the 1970s got to go in Australia. They bought them up cheap, obviously, and had pan and scan copies of it. There's none of this widescreen stuff with these videotapes. And Village Roadshow put out a whole bunch of them. There are any number of art house films. They did everything from R-rated movies. We couldn't get X-rated movies here in Australia after the first year of VHS and Betamax being available in Australia. But there were cut-down versions of Alpha France movies, for instance, with all of the hardcore pornography taken out that were released as softcore movies in Australia. There were children's films, ropey ones. There were action films, science fiction movies, fantasy movies, kung fu movies. Everything was released by Village Roadshow at the time. And Golden Needles was one of those films. I'll see if I can find a picture of it, of the VHS cover, to put it up on the website at paleocinema.blogspot.com. But yeah, this is very much one of those kind of... It's a bit, maybe it did show in drive-ins, because, yeah, 1974, it would have shown in drive-ins, but I don't recall having seen it advertised as such. I know that I saw it in the 1970s in a hardtop cinema when all of the great big grand cinemas in Sydney were having a hard time of things and were just kind of showing any kind of movie they could get cheaply to get bums on seats and to, you know, have people watch them. And Golden Needles really fills that bill. Particularly after that initial crazy time in 1973 when kung fu movies really came good. Anything with a vaguely kung fu motif would get a cinema release in Australia because there was definitely a market for it, and a whole bunch of stupid young guys like me would go and see them endlessly. And I kind of miss that. I mean, I do like the fact that I can sit on my ass in my lounge room and access pretty much every movie I've ever seen in one means or another, either legally or illegally. I'm not making judgment calls here because we're all guilty of it. But I'd still like those days when movies were less accessible. Now, I'm trying to explain to myself as much as to you guys why that's the case. I did like the fact that I had to travel enormous distances, for instance, to see Hammer Horror films in Bondi Junction, where they were the only cinema they were showing in Australia was an old run-down cinema, The Star at Bondi Junction, which they turned for about a year, around the time this movie was being made, The Golden Needles. They turned it into a horror movie cinema, and Hammer's back catalogue was suddenly allowed to be shown in Australia because horror films were censored up until the change to the R-rated system. So, yeah, I would travel literally 60 kilometres on a train to see some of these films because they weren't accessible to me any other way. And movies like Golden Needles were pretty much the same thing for me. And I kind of liked the fact that what I usually did was I'd have a couple of movie magazines and a paperback novel in a bag and maybe something to munch on if I was running a bit short of money and needed to save the money for the ticket to the movies. And I'd get on a train and just ride a train from Liverpool, southwest of Sydney, into the city, change trains again to get out to Bondi, or even a bus. I'm not sure whether the Bondi Junction train line was working there, but probably a bus out to Bondi Junction and watch the movie and then reverse the whole trip at all to get all the way to get home. So it was like minimum 2-hour trip just to see a couple of films in a cinema. And I would do that on a regular basis, and a lot of people did. And, it's amazing how, from that point of view, technology's changed so much that things are a lot more accessible. But I did like the idea. I did like going out and going to suburbs that I could have never afford to live in to watch things. And to get to know Sydney well. One of the reasons why I know my hometown so well, and when we went back there in October, I could drive around Sydney with no trouble at all, no need for directions, nothing like that, was the fact that a lot of my younger years were spent traipsing around all parts of Sydney. I mean, I'd go out to Parramatta, I'd go out to Double Bay in the eastern suburbs. So my kind of spread of, I had about a 60, 70 kilometre spread of places I'd go to see movies just because they weren't available anywhere else. And that's left me with a legacy of having an internalised map of Sydney that really does serve me well when I go back home. But yeah, Golden Needles, not a fantastic film, but a little bit of fun, not politically correct at all, a lot of interesting actions, a little bit of good character actor action there. And while it's not going to be on anyone's list of favourite movies of all time, it's just a little bit of a nostalgic entertainment and worth seeing for that reason. So I'm going to take another break now. When I get back, we're going to talk about a much more serious and much more adept film, which is Don Siegel's 1974 spy movie set in England, The Black Windmill, starring Michael Caine, Janet Sussman, John Vernon, and Donald Pleasance. And I'm going to play a bit of the stuff that Donald Pleasance does in this movie because it's a lot of fun.
Where the hell have you been working?
You know everybody, I believe. General St. John, Mr. Heppenstall, Admiral Valentine. Sorry to drag you all this way out of town. Can't shake this damn flu. And we want to know if you succeeded in penetrating the sabotage ring yet.
I saw the woman Seal Barrows this morning.
Who's she?
We've linked her with a man who's part of the ring.
And whom I believe to be a Soviet agent, Sean Connery.
What?
Kelly. Sean Kelly.
My God, Harper, who gave me a start. Commie's going that far.
That's just a little bit from The Black Windmill. 1974 movie starring Michael Caine, Donald Pleasance, etc. Directed by Don Siegel. Michael Caine has not been kind about this movie himself. He thought it was a very run-of-the-mill thriller. The original plan was to do it for British television, but they found it was a bit too violent, so it was turned into a theatrical film. And I think it works kind of much better as that, because there are some bits of it that really wouldn't have played well on TV and probably won't to this day. I'll give the IMDb pricey because it's pretty brief and it kind of gets to the point. A British agent's son is kidnapped and held for ransom of diamonds. The agent finds out they can't even count on the people he thought were on his side to help him, so he decides to track down the kidnappers himself. And from a book called Raising Cain, about the life and career of Michael Caine, there's a nice brief bit on the plot. It says, Caine starred as Major John Tarrant, forced to raid his own foreign office safe for a case of diamonds after an armed syndicate kidnaps his son. And that's pretty much it. It's rock-solid thriller. Michael Caine has said that he, after Harry Palmer, he wasn't sure he'd ever play a secret agent again, but he chose to do it in this one, and he wanted to work with Don Siegel. So he met him, and he found they were kind of simpatico, they were compatible. But he thinks the movie just really doesn't work. But I kind of disagree. In retrospect, I think it works kind of well. And there's a lot to like about the film. Don Siegel was just coming off a really successful run of movies when he made this one, which wasn't a financial success. The movies he did before this one were The Beguiled in 1971, Dirty Harry in 71, Charlie Varrick, which had Joe Don Baker in it, of course, in 73, and then The Black Windmill. He then went on to do The Shootist, Escape from Alcatraz, Rough Cut, and the movies he did before that that are kind of the best of their type were things like he did, if you want to catch an early Don Siegel movie that was really good, apart from Invasion of the Body Snatchers. He also did Private Hill 36, which I've talked about on the podcast, the Ida Lupino movie. You've got Ride and Cell Block 11, which is really good. I like that one a hell of a lot. Very gritty, very hard, and very hardcore in that sense. But there's another one called, let me just find it here, Edge of Eternity in 1959 that he did with Cornel Wilde and Victoria Shaw. It was a big CinemaScope film, nice action thriller. Pretty much a forgotten Don Siegel film, but I really like it a lot. I think that there's some terrific stunt work in it. I won't spoil it for you, but if you get a chance to see Edge of Eternity, go and see it or grab it to see it, because it really does have a great momentum to it. And Don Siegel was very good at action kind of cinema. Now, people are making plays, this is a run-of-the-mill spy movie, but there's a couple of things that take it out of the ordinary. First one is the fact that it personalises the Cold War to a big extent. There's a double agent in the people who are in charge of John Tarrant's department. And the department's got a really cool name too. It is the Office of Subversive Warfare, for instance. It's run out of a business front, which is an antiques business, and auction house, which is kind of cool. I always like those spy movies where basically the spy headquarters is hiding behind something else. They did it in The Man from U.N.C.L.E. with a tailor store in New York City, and they did it in the Harry Palmer films with an employment agency and a fireworks importer and a few other things. But yeah, I kind of miss that in modern spy stuff. It'd be interesting to go back to that, kind of having a spy headquarters hidden as something else. So with the way surveillance works these days, I'm not sure it'd be a very viable option. And that's one of the other things about this movie. Looking at a 1974 spy film, you see how much security's changed, even just in an office environment. It's all about people knocking on the doors and someone pressing a buzzer under a desk to open a security door. And it really is kind of low tech by our lights. Now, comparing it to a movie like The November Man, the Pierce Brosnan movie from 2014 that I mentioned at the start of the podcast, where part of the tracking of people is done with surveillance drones, and just little ones you can stick in the back of a car. Things have changed a lot in the espionage industry. But this one starts out really bad for the children. There's two kids who are kidnapped because they stray onto the area where the bad guys are hanging out in a disused Air Force base near their school where they're boarding, and one of them is the son of John Tarrant. They're kidnapped by the bad guys led by John Vernon, who people remember from a lot of things, including the fact that he was the school Dean in Animal House. He was also one of the bad guys in Point Blank, the John Borman film starring Lee Marvin. John Vernon has been all over everything, and in this one he's quite good as well. Daphne Selrig's in it as well. You might remember her best for Daughters of Darkness, the kind of stylish Euro vampire movie from around the same time, where she plays a very sexy and seductive vampire lady. But in this one, she's a girlfriend of one of the John Vernon character, who's in charge of the guys who are busy importing arms into Northern Ireland, so the IRA have something to work with. And that's being financed, of course, by Eastern Europe and communist interests. Well, that shit doesn't matter. Basically, there's diamonds involved. There's a lot of money involved. There's a double agent high up in the intelligence service for which Michael Caine's character works. And then there's the loveliness that is Donald Pleasance playing Harper, his boss, basically. Donald Pleasance rocking a mustache and picking at the mustache all the time. He's a rabid, the character's a rabid anti-smoker. He loves going down to the target range underneath the building and firing off a pistol. He loves gadgets, including an exploding briefcase, which is used to great effect during the movie. And Donald Pleasance's character is a crack shot as well. So basically, there's all these little bits of business that give the character of Harper a bit more fleshing out than they might have had otherwise. Rather than having Tarrant be briefed by him in an office the kind of way they do at the start of a James Bond film, for instance, they choose to do it down in those places, and that then gives them a chance to flesh out the character of Harper, who in essence isn't that important a character, but Donald Pleasance does such a lovely job of it. It's good to see very much a secondary character being fleshed out in this one. Now, Janet Sussman, a British stage actor, plays the wife of John Tarrant in this movie, and she's really good as well. Michael Caine has said of her that she was really intense, and he wasn't used to working with an actor, you know, a female actor, playing his partner of kind of such intensity, and that he found her a little bit overwhelming at times. But on the other hand, I think she does a fantastic job playing Alex, his wife. There are all sorts of other character actors who turn up in this one as well. Clive Rebel, the New Zealand actor, playing one of the policemen investigating things. Joss Ackland's in there playing another police officer. Dennis Quilley, who people might remember from Privates on Parade, a movie that I'm going to have to do in a future podcast. But, the ensemble is really good, and I really do like the ensemble in the cast. British movies at this time, particularly spy movies, always had really crisply good character actors in them. But in a sense, I really think, and watching this carefully, even though Michael Caine is very good playing Tarrant, he's playing a very upright character and very much unlike Harry Palmer. He's middle class, he's not working class where Harry Palmer was. And he dresses totally differently. He dresses slightly modern, wearing a modern 1970s style suit, and doesn't particularly look like a secret agent, but obviously is one. Now, there's a little bit of him together with Donald Pleasance in this that I really want to play, because I like the writing in this and I like the way the two actors are playing it. This is after Tarrant's son's been kidnapped and Harper is investigating things and the police are involved and other agencies are involved.
Kindly have the goodness not to smoke in here. These dry sinai are abnormally sensitive to air pollution. If you want to poison yourself, that's your affair. Kindly don't include me in your suicide plot. Or my dry sinai. I thought it would be helpful if I brought you up to date. You realize, of course, that a leak of serious magnitude has taken place within this department. If Drabble is privy to the information he's already given us, we must assume that he has knowledge which could endanger the safety and security of this entire country and put countless lives at risk.
I appreciate that the security aspect is your main concern. Mine is the safety of my son.
Yes, quite. I'm sure you know we're doing everything possible. bill of sale from Rand Goodbody. The stones.
Are you going to give them to him?
Have you any reason to think they won't?
It just seems a great deal of money for the life of one small boy.
I hope you don't mind my saying this, but, I have been observing you since this affair began, and you seem to me to be remarkably composed for a man in your predicament.
No. Isn't that what I'm trying to do? Hide my feelings?
I suppose so, yes. Well, that's all for the moment. I just wanted to keep you in the picture.
Yes. Well, thank you very much, sir.
Oh, Major Tarrant, I expect you saw General St. John leaving.
Yes.
I don't mind telling you how much I resent his MI5 snoopers poking about in our MI6 affairs. However, the General may wish to ask you a few questions. There are certain aspects of this business which he finds quite baffling about your involvement, principally.
Involvement?
It's a noun. The Oxford English Dictionary defines it as the condition of being implicated, entangled, or engaged.
You know exactly what my involvement is.
Yes, I know. Well, I'll see you at 11 o'clock.
I really like that scene for a number of reasons. You've got Harper's eccentricity with these plants that he doesn't want cigarette smoke on. You've got him being very perceptive and with the interdepartmental stuff. We later on learn that he does speak fluent French as well. And there's the implication, which Harper tells him, that he knows that Tarrant's not involved in the plot to get the diamonds and he hasn't faked his son's kidnapping. But he also knows that he has to deal with other instrumentalities that believe that. And John Vernon and Delphine Selrig provide extra evidence that Tarrant is involved in the robbery, or well, the attempt to extort the money, the diamond, sorry. And they provide that due to the fact that he and his wife, Alex, are separated and not living together, and he lives in a flat by himself. And when the cops turn up, they find some incriminating evidence against him, which has been planted there by Vernon's character, who's using the pseudonym of Drabble. And Seal, played by Delphine Selrig, have kind of set him up almost like a reverse honey trap in espionage. Now, if you don't know what a honey trap is in espionage, you can Google it because it's a very interesting concept. But anyway, the action scenes are great too. There's a lot of scenes of Michael Caine dodging people who are following him, which are done on the streets of London and are really crisply directed. I mean, people say that this isn't a good Don Siegel action film, but it very much is. Don Siegel, this was Don Siegel's first film directed in Europe, but on the other hand, he does have a great knowledge of London because he was educated in the UK. I mean, it's not commonly known that Don Siegel was actually a Cambridge-educated person, and he also studied at the Beaux-Arts in Paris. All this before he would turn 20, of course, and he made his way to LA and then started work in the Warner Brothers Film Library for Hal Wallace and worked his way up into directing films. So he was not an unsophisticated guy. He knew Europe pretty well. He knew Paris well. He knew London well. All from his very early days. So there you go. People think of Don Siegel very much as an American-based guy and very much American-centric. But he did have a breadth of knowledge about other places, which has held him in good stead with this movie. And there's also a great climax in the Jack and Jill windmills, which are some heritage-listed windmills in the UK, which are in Sussex, West Sussex, I believe. But, the black windmill is one of those two windmills. There's a white one and there's a black one. It's a Jack and Jill windmills in Clayton, West Sussex, England, UK, according to IMDb. And there's a really tense chase scene between Tarrant and Drabble, played by John Vernon, in the windmill, in the confined spaces of the windmill. And Siegel manages to convey some really tense stuff to use what will be in a windmill as part of the action, which is always an important thing with action films, is to use whatever you'd find on the location as a part of the action. And Siegel very much successfully does that. And there's a chase which also involves not Uzis, but Ingram MAC-10 submachine guns, which were kind of a very cool weapon of the day. And MAC-10s are kind of compact. They were used for urban warfare situations. And the climax of the film, in that sense, does rely very heavily on the use of MAC-10s, which is kind of cool, just watching them chew up heritage-listed bits of windmills as Michael Caine chases John Vernon around the windmill. One of the other things, too, is that I think Don Siegel handles the character scenes very well. There's a scene with Michael Caine in hospital. One of the two boys has been released, not his son, but the other boy. But unfortunately, the poor kid's been dosed up on LSD, and Michael Caine's character, Tarrant, interviews him in a hospital. And this is one of the things about this film, is they're not scared to hurt children in the film. And that's something that we now find incredibly transgressive in cinema. But at the time, it was a way of conveying things in a very powerful way. And even though it is, for our culture, and particularly in Western cinema, very much a taboo. People don't want to see children being hurt or killed. But this movie very much manages to dodge that one by having some kids fairly seriously hurt. And I know that's a trigger thing for some people, but I think it is central to the plot and the menace that is portrayed in the film. Even though some of it is only heard rather than seen, it really does ramp up the stakes for Tarrant to know that his son is in genuine danger and not just being held by a bunch of softies. He's being held by hardened criminals. And that very much is an important part of the plot. Let's see, what else is there? And the climax of the ending isn't on a big scale either. That windmill, confining the action to a windmill, really does make it a very tight and tense situation rather than having it on a big open stage. So rather than, say, doing what he did on Charlie Varrick, where it was out on a big paddock using aeroplanes and a car, the climax of this movie is very much on a smaller scale, but no less tense and no less interesting for that. There's not too much else to say about the film. I kind of like these ones where they fall between the cracks and people don't remember them. People remember Charlie Varrick, for instance. They remember Dirty Harry, definitely, but they don't remember this one as a Don Siegel film. But it does have all the hallmarks of a Siegel film and really kind of works well from what I can see. And it's a kind of forgotten Michael Caine film. He did a lot of shit in the 1970s and 1980s as he had a bit of problem with somebody stealing some of his money. And he kind of had to rebuild his fortune in a sense. But I don't think this is one of them. I definitely think this is a film that sits comfortably in that B spy movie kind of thing without the flash and the glitz of a James Bond film or one of the Euro spy movies that emulated James Bond films. But it's a little more Le Carré than that. And it kind of works really solidly as a B action film. And I think that it should be respected as such too. Okay, that's about it for this time around. There is no feedback. I'm not sure whether it's my doing or your doing. But you can leave feedback at cultguru, K-U-L-T-G-U-R-U @gmail.com. Be very happy to accept it, either in written or else in audio form, if you can do an MP3. So I'm going to leave you with a track to end things off, and then I'm going to put the credits on the end of the podcast as per usual. Just another reminder that the Patreon campaign is out there. You can donate as little as $1 per month to help keep the podcast going, and it'd be very nice if you did so. And anyway, I'll be back in 2 weeks' time with something totally different. And in the meantime, look after yourselves, take care, hug the ones you love, and keep watching good films. This is Richard Hawley with Tonight the Streets Are Ours.
Do you know why you got feelings in your heart? Don't let fear of feeling fool you. What you see sets you apart. And there's nothing here to bind you. It's no way for life. streets are ours. These lights in our hearts, they tell no lies. Those people, they got nothing in their souls, and they make our TVs blind us. My vision and our goals. Oh, the trigger of time, it tricks you, so you have no way to grow. But do you know that tonight the streets are ours? Tonight the streets are ours. These lights in our hearts, they tell no lies, and no one else can haunt me the way that you can haunt me. I need to know you want me. I couldn't be without you and the light that shines around you. No, nothing ever mattered more than not doubting. The streets are ours. Do you know how to kill loneliness at last? Oh, there's so much there to heal, dear, and make tears things of the past. But do you know that tonight the streets are ours? Tonight the streets are ours. These lights in our street are ours. Tonight the streets are ours. These lights in our hearts, they tell no lies.
And once again, it's time to thank all of the Patreon podcast subscribers. And here are the credits in the style of movie credits. I'd like to thank Alyssa, the location scout, Tansy, the Foley artist, Miss Jane, the wardrobe mistress, Christopher, the gaffer, Chris, the camera operator, Julia, the casting director, Jane, the dialect coach, Gary, the prop master, Morris, the musical director, Armin, the key grip, Tom, the focus puller, Sarah, the special effects director, Ian, the caterer, Grant, the technicolor consultant, Matt-O-Matic, the rattlesnake wrangler, and our new one, Elaine, the scientific advisor. And I'd also like to thank Sally. She's the assistant to Mr. Frost. Thanks to all of the subscribers. And the music in the background you're hearing is Claude Debussy playing Gollywog's Cakewalk from a piano roll of his.